I grew more and more desperate to win Sue over as the summer went by. So by the last week of August, I was in a state of silent panic. That is how I characterize my misguided, bizarre mindset, and it's the only explanation I can find for the completely retarded stunt that I resorted to one sunny afternoon just before she left. The day started out pretty normal, as I recall. I made plans with some friends to play wiffle ball in my backyard around 1 p.m. I then spoke to Sue, who half-heartedly asked me if I wanted to come along with her while she ran errands in her mother's car, a 77 Ford Granada. Parents love a car like that because it's slow and boring and safe. They feel entirely comfortable loaning a car like that to their teenagers, because the only kind of death it will cause is dying of embarrassment. Sue had quite a few items to buy and loose ends to tie up before making her big move to college, so this run was going to take all morning. I agreed to go with her before she described the dull and tedious list of stops we'd have to make. Not that it would have made a difference to me. I was being presented with an entire morning to work my magic every which way on her. There were going to be opportunities to woo her left and right. Surely this would be the day that Sue fell forever for Artie. It didn't quite work out that way, but not for a lack of trying. From the moment she picked me up, I looked for any excuse to show off my absolutely charming sense of spontaneity. Sadly, I found no openings apart from my usual and constant busting of chops all around. And I was even coming up short in that department. I really hadn't considered just how boring a morning of pre-college errands can be. As should be apparent by now, Sue was way more mature than I was. She already had her own bank account and a checkbook, which to me was very impressive. The final errand of the morning was stopping off at the bank to deposit a check. I'd gotten nowhere in my mission, and I was very aware of the fact that this was the end of the ride, so to speak. So I decided to go into the bank with her and at the very least bust some more chops. When we got inside, Sue went to the back to do her banking while I walked around like a boob, unsuccessfully avoiding boredom. The only thing that aroused my interest was a teller in one of the front windows. A really cute broad in her mid-20s with dark hair and nice tits. I looked around, saw that Sue was occupied, and then went over to the table that held all of the different slips and picked up a pen. I was already a huge fan of Woody Allen by then, and I especially liked the film Take the Money and Run. In one of the funniest scenes of the movie, Woody's character, Virgil Starkwell, writes a stick-up note on the back of a bank deposit slip, but his handwriting is so poor that the teller can't read it. She thinks that the word gun is the word gub and reads it out loud and asks him what a gub is and blows his whole plan. If you haven't seen that movie, you should. I highly recommend it. In a misguided homage to that scene, I thought the best thing I could possibly do at that moment would be to write a fake hold-up note on the back of a deposit slip and hand it to this cute teller. Like a moron, I figured it would go down like this. I'd hand it to the girl, she would laugh, knowing right away that it was a joke. She'd probably even seen the movie. And even if she didn't, what I'd done would be so funny to her that she'd become terribly attracted to me. Sue would then see me pull this prank off, and the combination of my successful gag and the cute teller digging me would win her over instantly, and college be damned, she would be mine. In my mind, this plan was extra crazy, but it was what the situation called for, so it made complete sense. I remember the note I wrote almost word for word, mostly because the judge read it back to me about 50 times in juvenile court, as you will soon see. It went like this. I have a gun. Put $50,000 into a bag. Turn around and count to 1,000. Please act casually. Thank you for your cooperation, and I signed it Artie Lang, Jr. I wish I was bullshitting you with this one, but I'm not. I really am that retarded. I didn't consider that this teller might freak out because probably at least once she'd worried about having a gun stuck in her face at work. No, to me the fact that I'd signed the note was indication enough to anybody that I was joking. Brilliant! Assured that I had finally come up with the grand slam of gags, I walked up to the window and handed the girl my note. I then slammed into a brick wall called reality. My signature, as the foolproof indication that this was a joke, meant shit to her. The first thing that this girl read was, I have a gun, and it was over. She turned white as a ghost, started shaking, and looked like she was about to start sobbing. I immediately panicked and grabbed the note out of her hand. It's a joke, I said, trying to keep my voice down. Really, it was a joke. It's just a joke. I am so, so sorry. The teller took a deep breath and looked relieved and started to calm down a bit. It seemed like she believed me. About this time, I saw Sue coming my way. I am really sorry, I said, trying to smile benevolently. I was just trying to make you laugh. I wasn't serious at all, I promise. Then I got away from her window as fast as I could. I crumpled up the note, threw it into the nearest trash can, and walked over to Sue. That was another sign that I'm both retarded and not cut out for a life of crime. I stupidly left behind the piece of evidence that would come back to bite me in the ass. Sue knew nothing at all about what had happened, and I chose not to tell her, thinking as we got back into her mother's car that I'd dodged a bullet. Sue drove me home to my wiffle ball game and told me she was heading to Mandy's on Route 22 to shop for clothes for college. Great, I said. I'll call you later. I headed into the backyard and played wiffle ball with my buddies Deed, Shecky, Larry, and Kevin. Those guys are not relevant to the story in any way whatsoever, but I promised them that I'd put their names in my audiobook. So now that I've done that, we can move on. As my friends and I ascended into wiffle ball heaven, the real drama was unfolding elsewhere. Back at the bank, the teller might have managed a half a smile and acted like it was okay at the end of our ordeal, but she failed to mention that during her initial panic, she remembered enough of her training video to trigger the silent alarm that went straight to the local police station. 30 seconds after Sue and I walked out of the bank and drove away, a mini SWAT team pulled up to the back entrance prepared to handle an armed bank robbery in progress. When they didn't find one, the teller explained what had happened. But if there's one group of people that sure as hell wasn't going to see the humor in a shitheaded prank like that, it's a SWAT team. I have no idea how convincing the teller was in upholding my innocence, but it wouldn't have mattered if she were as earnest as Sally Field accepting her Oscar. There was no keeping those cops from arresting me. It really was my lucky day, because not only was I, Artie Lang Jr., officially the jerk-off who'd left sign evidence of his misguided practical joke right there in the bank, I had also messed with a teller who'd managed to write down the license plate number of Sue's mom's car as we drove away. It says nothing of that broad's grace under pressure. Sue's mom's Granada had as much pickup as a covered wagon, so if she wanted to, the girl could have cried for a few minutes, then sharpened a pencil, walked around the desk and outside to the sidewalk, put on her glasses, and written down the plate number before we were out of visual range. It was some getaway car, let me tell you. The thing is, even if she hadn't written that down, it wasn't going to take Sherlock Holmes to find us, considering that the bank had Sue's home address. I guess that it took the SWAT team 30 minutes or less to figure all of this out. Drive to Sue's house and surround the place like it was Waco. Her parents, thank God, were at work, but her sister Teresa was not. Now, I love Teresa. I really did. But there's one thing that I have to say about her. To this day, she is the loudest broad I have ever met. Normal people have what you'd call a speaking voice, a whisper, and a yell. Now think of the average person you know yelling your name across a crowded party at a sports event, or just before you're about to step in front of an oncoming bus. Teresa's whisper was as loud as that. She could carry on a conversation comfortably over the sound of a jet engine. That afternoon, the cops stormed into Sue's house and found Teresa, who was pretty high-strung and probably screamed and had a panic attack as they explained to her that they were looking for Sue, her mother's Ford Granada, and an unidentified male her sister had been seen with. All three were wanted in connection with an attempted bank robbery. In a frenzy, Teresa called my house, and I answered the phone on an extension that we had in our garage. I wasn't at all happy about it either, because I was in the middle of a nothing-nothing wiffle ball game that was heading into the 11th inning. It was a classic wiffle ball pitcher's duel. "Yeah, hello," I said. The moment she heard my voice, Teresa unloaded a primal yell that pierced my skull. It was so loud that all of my friends heard it and got quiet. "Artie!" she shouted. "The cops are here looking for Sue! What the fuck did you get her into? Whatever it is, I know it's your fault! What is it, Artie? Is it drugs? If Sue gets arrested and cannot go to college, I will not be able to move into her bedroom, and I will never fucking forgive you. I know it's fucking drugs." I had no idea what was going on, and there was no way I was getting a word in edgewise. It wouldn't have mattered. I did not possess what it was going to take to calm Teresa down, but I tried anyway. And then it hit me. The teller must have called the cops. But the cops didn't have Sue yet, so I thought that if I found her first, there was a chance I could turn this around somehow. I told Teresa not to worry, though I doubt she heard me over the sound of her own screaming. I hung up, borrowed my buddy Deej's blue 1980 Camaro, and raced to Mandy's on Route 22. I found Sue in the dressing room trying on a shitty mid-80s $14 blouse, the likes of which you'd find on an extra in a Bangles video. She was surprised to see me, but not surprised by the story. When I told her the whole thing, she just started laughing. She knew she hadn't done anything, and that I was the one in trouble, so there was no need to make a huge deal of it. She was a really cool chick. We did, however, have to deal with the cops, so on the advice of my buddy's uncle, who was a lawyer, we called the police station and revealed ourselves as the teenage Bonnie and Clyde they were hunting for. They told us to come down to the station to surrender ourselves, which we did. Sue was so upbeat about the whole situation that I started to think maybe this plan hadn't backfired after all. Maybe I'd actually done it. Maybe I'd finally managed the grand gesture that was bold and funny enough to win her heart. Sue laughed all the way to the station and all the way inside until they handcuffed us together. Then her carefree attitude about it changed to terror. "Artie, why are we handcuffed?" she said. "I didn't do anything. What's going to happen to us? Why am I in handcuffs?" "I don't know," I said. "Why are you asking me? I have no idea what the fuck is going to happen." It really didn't help any to say that to Sue.